Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Hello, listeners. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the Wathaurong land right now, and we'd like to acknowledge our past, present, and definitely the future people,
leaders of the
land.
Thank you, Jackie, and good morning, listeners, and welcome to what today is the Climate Emergency Room. And I say that specifically because we know what an emergency room is, but today the Sustainable Hour is an emergency room in a climate context because we have someone who is very familiar with this expression, climate emergency. She's written a booklet about it, Jane Morton, who is also a psychologist. We'll come back to her. First of all, welcome to Colin Mockett and the global outlook, the world view. What do you have for us today, Colin?
Hello, Mick. Well, first of all, I have to say that at the beginning, instead of news, we heard the Pell verdict being outlined still by the judge, and Dennis is monitoring it in the next door studio, and he said that he would come in and let us know, and we can cut in with this if you're interested in hearing
Absolutely.
That again.
And you know what? I have a sermon from a church where I'm thinking, after we've heard the verdict, let's play that sermon, because I'm wondering, where is the church when we talk about the climate emergency? And speaking of this person that we're here talking about, do you know that he actually was a little bit of a fossil fuel agent, you know, against the Pope, who was actually his employer? He was conspiring in the sense that he was gathering people from the so-called science, holding meetings with them in Rome about that there is no climate change.
Emergency. It's an ultra-right-wing position that he's taken throughout his life. And to say that in the 21st century, politics and religion don't mix is completely, clearly wrong. But look, what I wanted to talk to you about today, and while we're waiting for this to come through, is that I had a birthday last week, as you know. And I have a sister-in-law who describes me as a gentleman eco-warrior. And she she gave me the most amazing of birthday presents. She gave me a whole bunch of toilet rolls. And along with those toilet rolls was a spiel, a screed of things that I wasn't really aware of. And that is that our planet uses 9 million trees per year simply to create toilet rolls. And toilet rolls, that collates to 27,000 trees per day being chopped down so that we can enjoy the luxury, if you like, of using a piece of paper to dispose of some of our waste, our personal waste. Now, not only do we lose those number of trees, which is, when you work it out, 15% of the world's deforestation is purely due to toilet rolls. All of these were part of the screed that was given to me last week. So this company, which is called Pure Planet, has come up with an alternative. And I bring you one of them here now. You can have a little look at it. First of all, it is not wrapped in plastic. It uses no plastic at all. Even when they're wrapped in packets of 30, you can get them in. And the whole thing itself uses no trees. No plastic, no trees. It's created from bamboo and sugarcane waste. The sugarcane waste that was previously burned. So that would be creating part of the atmospheric pollution. So bamboo and sugarcane waste, 100% plastic free, 100% wood free. And these can be delivered to your house. And they cost less than $1 a toilet roll. They cost $28 for 30 of them. Have a little look at them. They look and feel just like standard soft luxury toilet roll, with the difference that they're wrapped in tissue paper as opposed to plastic. And the reason that they are delivered to your house is because the supermarkets who have got the monopoly on selling toilet rolls the way things are at the moment, the supermarkets are multinationals and they're not really interested in helping the planet.
Thank you, Carl. Butting in on your show, guys, George Pell has received 6 years, a sentence of 6 years, and he must serve 3 years and 8 months before being eligible for parole. Thanks, guys.
And if it's any of your interest at all, that was my bet, because we're running a book in the studio next door. I had the 6 years. Dennis owes me a coffee. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Today was talking toilet rolls to you, which seems sort of significant, really, I suppose.
Well, it's something that we probably use the most. No, well, you would like to think that everybody does use toilet paper.
Well, they don't. It's only us... First world. Basically.
Really?
Yeah. In the, what we call the developing world, if you go to India, very rare, it's only the tourists that use toilet paper, you know. And much of the Middle East, the left hand is unclean. Everything is done, you eat with your right hand, and the left hand is used for, cleaning yourself, and then afterwards you wash your hands.
Mm.
They don't have the same fascination with using bits of paper that we do.
The Sustainable Hour.
In just 2 days from now, thousands and thousands, we don't know how many, but certainly hundreds of thousands of school kids are going to leave their schools and go to city halls, go in front of senators and parliamentarians' offices, going to parliaments, etc., in 1,000 different cities around the planet. And, I mean, the numbers are, like, rising by the day, but at the moment it's something like 80 different countries where the school strike for climate is happening. This is the next generation speaking up. With Greta Thunberg from Sweden, who was the single girl who sat out in front of Parliament half a year ago, where we reported about it here in Australia. And look what has happened because of one person's action.
Yep.
There were four of these school strikers who spoke at the Sustainable Living Festival. And I think they set the agenda for this hour here pretty well. So have a listen here what's happening and coming up here this Friday.
And so let's hear a little bit from Marco as well, and then we've heard from everybody on the panel to start with. I know that you weren't one of the organisers of that first strike in November, but you've since become quite visible through your question on Q&A and rebuttal of the bullshit response that you got from the panellists. It's been, yeah. And what's been your role to start? How did you get started, and what's your role now?
Yeah, in terms of how I got started, basically I really got started a couple of years ago when I heard some speakers from Standing Rock campaign, and just learning how damaging these practices are to these communities, how they're destroying their culture, their land, their water, and let alone the environmental and global impacts of that has. Yeah, I really felt that I had to do as much as I could to really ensure that we have and protect and preserve the only livable planet we know. So in terms of the school strike, the first one, I wasn't too involved and kind of just jumped on board with it. But then, yeah, since then I've felt like I really need to get involved, and I've been helping out with various means of communication and partnerships, and also trying to see what we can do more than just marching, just striking, to really reach out and show how serious this climate catastrophe is, rather than just striking for one day and going back to school the next. Like, really, how we can sustain and make this thing a bit more disruptive, a bit more in the politicians' face, and an issue they can't ignore.
Because you're independent, aren't you? I mean, you're
absolutely, you'd make, yeah. We're completely non-partisan. That's one of the driving forces behind this, because we all agree that this isn't a left versus right issue. This is a human issue. This is just a problem with the world. And if we became partisan, then that sort of disrupts that message. So we make it really clear: it doesn't matter where you fall on the political spectrum. You need to have good climate policy, and that's the main thing that's driving us. Yeah.
I want to find out about how your parents have responded to, you know, you playing this role.
I think my parents would rather me be alive and uneducated than dead and educated. I think really they just care about my safety and well-being, and they understand too that this is an existential threat. This is more important. So they're super supportive.
I think if we're looking on like a political level, we do have our three main goals, which are full renewable energy by 2030, to stop Adani, and for no new sources of fossil fuels. So those are very clear goals, they're very clear demands. And I think the way that people could help, particularly adults, is when you're looking at voting, look at these demands, look at what we need for climate action.
We would love every one of you to come in support and solidarity with the school strikes, and yeah, to really get this message out there.
You know, I wouldn't be doing anything else either, so I was like, you know, might as well save the planet in the meantime.
So that was Harriet and Jack Veer, Sean and Marco, who spoke at the Sustainable Living Festival, and it sort of explains what's going to happen this Friday, because this time again, like the 30th of November, kids are walking out of school and saying, we demand that politicians do better. That's basically what they're saying. But not just politicians, society as a whole and their own parents. They are talking to the adults in general, that the adults have failed them on climate change. In the studio, we have Steve Reddington, who's coming to us just with a short message about something, a decision that needs to be taken on Barwon Water, which is having something called an Environmental Advisory Committee. Is that right?
That's correct.
So welcome to the Sustainable Hour, and let us know what are the deadlines, and people can, you're calling out because you want people to participate, is that right?
That's right, Mick. So we're looking for community members and stakeholders from a diverse range of ages and backgrounds to join our Environmental Advisory Committee. We'd like to draw on your knowledge because we care about reducing our impact on the environment. Whether you're a member of our diverse community or a representative of an environmental organisation, we'd like to hear from you. So the members of the committee provide valuable feedback and local knowledge in relation to environmental and sustainability matters at Barwon Water. And we're also looking to collaborate on the development of a range of strategies, programs and projects that really optimise what we do around water-related resources and regional prosperity. So applications close on Sunday the 24th of March. Further information and the application form are available on our website at barwonwater.vic.gov.au/EAC.
And how many are you looking for?
So the committee has actually been in operation since 2000. It was previously called the Environmental Consultative Committee. And we've already got some great representation on there from examples such as Geelong Sustainability, Environment Victoria, and Geelong Field Naturalists, just to name a few. So we've currently got some vacancies. We're expanding the membership up to potentially up to 12 or 14 members in total from the current seven.
So you're looking for 6-8 people or something in that area?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And do they need to be... But can just residents, or are you looking for people in a group or a business that's related to
So we're open to both. Currently, we have representation from both general community members as well as representatives of key environmental groups. Mm. And so we're keen to maintain that diversity.
Yeah, great.
So the call is out there. And we'll put it on our Facebook page as well. It's important that we begin to engage in these matters. And as you said, we don't have to be experts to be part of this. And I should say, listeners, Barwon Water is one of our leaders when it comes to sustainability and taking action on climate change. It's amazing what you guys are doing. I'm very proud that we have Barwon Water in this city and the leadership that you're showing in how you manage the resources, but also how you manage, you know, how to run a company. It goes deep inside the organization. Good on you for doing all this. And this committee just adds onto it that you're actually calling out and engaging citizens and listening to what they would have to say, even if they're not water experts.
Mm. And what does it involve, Steve? Like what if somebody volunteers their time and well, you know, applies, what do they have to do?
So we have four meetings a year, and they're held about quarterly. in the evening, so about 5:30 till 7:30 p.m., and then we have a sort of an end-of-year tour on top of that. The EAC does consider a broad range of topics such as carbon emissions, renewable energy, water efficiency, integrated water management, water resource planning, catchment and waterway management, and recreational land use. So there's a real diversity of topics there to provide input on, and certainly the committee has been pivotal in setting our direction that we're moving toward now.
Thank you very much. Steve Reddington from Barwon Water.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Sustainable Hour.
In the studio, our guest of the hour is Jane Morton, a psychologist who's written a booklet, and you have it there in front of you. Welcome, Jane, to Geelong. You've come all the way from
Melbourne. Thank you very much.
We've talked a lot with you and about you.
Jane, Philip Adams holds it up to the microphone so the listeners can see him.
I'm holding it up to the camera.
Jane, tell us just in brief about that booklet.
Well, it came out about a year ago. It took actually a year and a half to write. I'm a psychologist, and the thing that was really bugging me was this thing that is all over our allies, our climate movement, climate scientists. Fear doesn't work. We mustn't tell people how bad it is because fear doesn't work. And it was just getting me more and more angry because I knew from the psychology research, the broader psychology research, it's just absolutely not true. You know, why would politicians use fear all the time, like stop the boats? Why would health campaigns use fear all the time? Like you think of pictures on packets of smokes or, you know, a campaign.
The fear of cancer. Yeah.
Yeah, vivid pictures, scary pictures. Same with speeding, drink driving. Every public health campaign you can think of tells you about the threat and tells you what you can do about it. And when it comes to emergency messages, there's not even any research because it's so obvious. Like if the fire's approaching Geelong, you don't hear the fire chief going, oh, we better not tell people, we might make people afraid. Or, you know, don't tell people that this fire is so big that you shouldn't stay and defend because you might make them panic. You know, there's no research because there's no dispute. And I think some of the research that was done that people still talk about, it was done when a lot of people still didn't think that climate was an emergency. Now it's absolutely clear it's an emergency. People going around saying we mustn't tell people, I think it's one of the biggest obstacles we face because people know about the lies. They can sort of protect themselves against the lies. But when you hear climate scientists and campaigners going around saying we mustn't tell people how bad this is, oh, that's why I wrote the book.
And what's the response been?
The response has been fantastic. I think it came out just partly by circumstance. I think at a time when the moment had come for that kind of message, we started campaigning to declare a climate emergency in 2016 when the reef bleached. I think that was a turning point for a lot of people where the damage became very tangible. But of course, since 2016 and, you know, 2017, 2018, I think it became clearer and clearer that we did face an emergency. And I think a lot of people were ready to shift, and instead of trying to keep going with this positive-only sort of messaging that had been the fashion for quite a number of years.
It certainly seems to be happening as we speak, yeah. Because now there's close to 400 councils, city councils around the planet, that have declared a climate emergency. And that's in a way because of what started here in Melbourne, isn't it? The movement for declaring a climate emergency, the website called climateemergencydeclaration.org. So the wording meant something. You know, just that expression, climate emergency, has really gone out. There's also the Extinction Rebellion movement that started up in the UK half a year ago.
Yes. Look, I think as soon as we started asking to declare a climate emergency, instead of just saying we want 100% renewables or we want to stop Adani, people in the street, ordinary people, had this enormous energy surge and this sense of relief. Like when we talk to people in the street, where they go is, yes, of course it's an emergency. Why is the government not doing anything? And I think as soon as we started, in a sense, telling the truth, things have run faster almost than we can keep up. So we were asking council candidates just in our local area to pledge to support the declaration of a climate emergency. And I think, in a sense, we didn't even really expect anything much to happen. We hoped they would just influence their political parties, you know, if they were from Labor or the Greens. But we got 2/3 of the candidates who were elected to support the declaration of a climate emergency. And they just went ahead and declared an emergency in our local area in Darabin straight after first council meeting. And then it sort of slowly has sort of gone off in Australia. But now it's across, I think, 5 different countries and 370 councils. And it seems to be almost, not really effortless, but almost effortless. It's just, it's like an idea whose time has come. And yes, and in terms of Extinction Rebellion, when I was writing the booklet, one of the ideas I really wanted to get across, again, it was another myth, that you mustn't talk about conflict and mass migration or food and water shortages because national security framing makes people right-wing. Well, I think you just have to tell the truth. It's the start of humans dying. And you have to tell people, humans are already dying and more will die. That's what the scientists say. We're facing human extinction, not just animals.
Can I just, I just want to just say something. This is just a common thing, I guess. Well, not common, but I'm driving to work today and I had my son in the car and we live on the coast. So as we drive, we often see dead animals on the road, you know, like a dead fox or a dead cat or, you know, that's pretty much it. But he said, we drove past a dead cat. And he said, oh, Mum, imagine, like, you know how we see animals dead on the side of the road? Imagine if we saw humans dead on the side of the road. And then I was like, oh, well, that would be horrible. And then, you know, without saying, well, that's what's going to happen because I don't actually know, then that kind of gives me that option of bringing up this emergency. And I spoke to him about the Murray-Darling River and how it's all dry down the, you know, right down the far end and why it's dry. And we actually had a really good conversation about that. So I guess, like, just that whole, when you say, oh, you know, like, animals, people are going to be dying, that's sort of that visual thing, isn't it? And when hopefully that's not going to be the case, that we're driving along and we see dead humans on the road. But, you know, like, you just kind of think, where is this going?
But look, partly I think we don't see them by the road, no. But we don't see them partly because our newspapers and our media are not telling us. Mm. I mean, there's been heat waves recently where tens of thousands in Europe have died. Tens of thousands. Imagine if it was a terrorist attack, how it would be all over every paper. But, oh, you know, it's 10,000 died. Oh, well, it's not even in the newspaper. People don't see it. So that's the problem with the emergency. Jane, you can't see it out the window very easily.
Yes.
Jane, I feel good about you being a psychologist, being with us today in the climate emergency room. And therefore, I dare to play a sermon from a church which was held here in January. And this is the kind of sermon, if you are listening out there, dear priests and dear church leaders, listen to what you could be doing in your church. I say that in this way because this guy, and his name is Chris Hedges, and he's speaking about death, but in a very, in my opinion, powerful way, and the way that the churches could be lifting this issue up. So let's for once, and we don't do that often, but let's for once talk about death in the Sustainable Hour. And then hopefully, Jane, afterwards, you will help us cheer up and get out of that gloomy, dark side of things, because I know you also have a lot of solutions in your hand. Give a listen here to Chris Hedges, who is giving a sermon on the 20th of January in America.
The issue before us is death. Not only our individual death, which is more imminent for some of us this morning than others, but our collective death. We have begun the sixth great mass extinction, driven by our 150-year binge on fossil fuel. The litany of grim statistics is not unfamiliar to many of you. We are pouring greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at 10 times the rate of the mass extinction known as the Great Dying, which occurred 252 million years ago. The glaciers in Alaska alone are losing an estimated 75 billion tons of ice every year. The oceans, which absorb over 90% of the excess heat trapped by greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, are warming and acidifying, melting the polar ice caps and resulting in rising sea levels and oxygen-starved ocean dead zones. We await a 50 gigaton burp or pulse of methane from thawing Arctic permafrost beneath the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, which will release about 2/3 of the total carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere since the beginning of the industrial era. Some 150 to 200 species of plant, insect, bird, and mammal are going extinct every 24 hours, 1,000 times the natural or background rate. The pace of extinction is greater than anything the world experienced since the disappearance of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Ultimately, feedback mechanisms will accelerate the devastation, and there will be nothing we can do to halt obliteration. Past mass extinctions on Earth were characterized by abrupt warming between 6 to 7 degrees Celsius. We are barreling toward those numbers. The mathematical models for this global temperature rise predict an initial 70% die-off of the human species, culminating with total death. The corporate forces that have commodified the natural world for profit have also commodified human beings. We are as expendable to global corporations as the barrier reef or the great sequoias. These corporations and ruling elites, which have orchestrated the largest transference of wealth upward in human history, with the globe's richest 1% owning half the world's wealth, kneel and force us to kneel before the dictates of the global marketplace. They have seized control of our governments, extinguishing democracy, corrupting law, and building alliances with neo-fascists and authoritarians. These corporate capitalists are the modern versions of the Canaanite priests who served the biblical idol Moloch, which demanded child sacrifice. And as in this ancient Canaanite religion, it is our children who are being sacrificed to these mute idols, as 1 Corinthians puts it. Their future is being taken from them. These corporate forces are, in biblical terms, forces of death. They will, unchecked, create more human misery and death than the evils of Nazism and Stalinism combined. On this planet, a great number of civilizations have perished in blood and horror. Naturally, one must wish for the planet that one day it will experience a civilization that has abandoned blood and horror. In fact, I am inclined to assume that our planet is waiting for this. But it is terribly doubtful whether we can bring such a present to its 100th or 400th million birthday party. And if we don't, the planet will finally punish us, its unthoughtful well-wishers, by presenting us with the last judgment. Religious belief, to be relevant, must be grounded in this concrete and bitter human reality.
A little excerpt here of a 20-minute long sermon by Chris Hedges, held on the 25th of January in a church in America. Jane Morton, what's your response? What's your reaction when you hear this? I mean, my first reaction is, my God, wouldn't it be nice if some priests and some church leaders, regardless of which religion, but if they began to speak up like this in the church, maybe then we would see the community getting more and on board and understanding what we are up against. What do you think?
Look, I think not just church leaders. What we need is all of our leaders. You know, humans are basically herd animals, and part of how we judge whether something is an emergency is by looking and seeing, well, what are leaders doing? we look and seeing leaders really doing nothing, we go, well, that's sort of weird. It seems like it's serious, but it doesn't look like it's serious. So I think that...
So we do nothing.
Well, yep. I think people are then confused. But what we need is congruence. One of the things that the Extinction Rebellion, this movement from the United Kingdom that's now spreading through the world in 80 countries, says is we have to tell the truth and act as though the truth is real.
Yeah.
So we have to tell the truth that it's an emergency, like we risk human extinction, and then we have to act as though we're serious about this. It doesn't mean, you know, another petition. It means we have to start standing up and, for me, you know, say, risk arrest. You have to do stuff.
Jane, there's the expression that the industry that's trying to protect its business is using a weapon of mass confusion.
They are.
You know, that they are deliberately spreading confusion just to delay the transition away from not using their products.
Look, I think they must be confused, because the thing about human extinction is that the wealthy people will not actually be exempt. If people understood, and if the confusion was lifted, if people understood, really, we're actually all going to die. We're at risk of the breakdown of human civilization. I think left, right and centre would all be united. And even those who profit most directly, if they really understood that their children would die from this, you know, I think would probably give it away. That's why I think telling the truth is the central thing. Because if people realise that the threat is to the whole of our existence, then I think it's the same as when the fire is coming to a town or the river is flooding. When it's a threat to your existence, you all work together.
Mm.
But we have to tell the truth. That's the key. And that's why it's so inspiring. Like, it's depressing to hear that sermon, but it's sort of uplifting. And that's the same thing that we find. As you tell the truth, people go, thank God someone's saying this out loud.
Exactly. And it's happening more and more. Just as we speak this Wednesday evening in New York, artists are getting together and calling for a climate emergency, using exactly that expression. And it's a new thing hear artists beginning to step up and using these kind of words. And here in the Sustainable Hour, we're getting artists who are sending in different messages where they are, you know, basically what they're doing is that they're giving their support to the kids who go on strike this Friday. Let's hear a couple of examples.
Hi, I'm Andrea Robertson, and along with the Sustainable Hour crew, I support the Students for Climate Strike. These kids are missing out on school so they can tell our politicians to take their futures seriously and treat climate change for what it is, a crisis. Support these kids as best you can, and as an adult who can vote, make your vote count and choose climate wisely. As they say in the Sustainable Hour, climate change is a political choice.
Hi, this is Dallas Holden, and along with the Sustainable Hour crew, I support the Students' Climate Strike. These kids know that we need to make changes now. It's our job as adults to make our vote count and choose climate wisely.
I'm Ralph Mattel, and I am so impressed with hashtag School Strike for Climate, which is going to take place in Geelong and around other Australian communities on Friday, the 15th of March. I commend every one of these students for taking this step and standing up to power to protect their futures. I don't think I was as aware as these children are about what power they have at their disposal to make such a protest, and I wish each and every one of them all the best for a successful outcome.
Sustainable people. That's about you and me. What can we do to get this world back on track?
We need to talk to each other, you and me, about our climate, about the changes, the emergency, and the solutions. But how do we do this so we get united and not separated? There is a risk of climate bashing when addressing this subject. I talked to Seda Moose.
I work in a school with children with special needs, and I'm also training to become a teacher. I think there's a clear logic to the fact that the population around the world is increasing, and there's only so much stretching can this earth do. We're going to run out of resources. But I think the important thing is I don't necessarily approach it from the climate bashing, because I don't care if people believe in climate change or they don't believe in climate change. You must believe in the fact that by putting out a full bin every week, you are adding to the problem. And you need to think about the fact that how can I reduce that starting from home? I suppose it's important not to alienate people, because sometimes if you come on too strong, they all just put up a fight saying, I'm too busy, I'm working. Useless excuses come up. It's hard to look at someone and judge them and, you know, tell them that how they can do it better without knowing what they're actually trying.
I think we should call it another name.
Maybe call it resourceful living, maybe call it responsible living, maybe understanding that we can do things better by making small changes, as opposed to living with the idea that we buy things in packages and the packages doesn't just disappear, you know? Maybe concentrate on the fact that not everything has to come in packages. The way I live is that I want to try and have a sustainable living while I meet the demands of present, but I also considering the fact that the future needs to have enough resources to continue. I think change happens from home. My way of doing it is leading by example, which is when I go shopping, I take my own mesh bag so I don't have to use the plastic bags when I buy grapes or beans. Everything can go on those bags. And similarly, if I go to butcher, I take my own Tupperware container, so I pass it to the butcher. And I like to think that I make people think about the fact that there's another option. Just a Tupperware container in your shopping bag is a solution. To be perfectly honest, I'm never afraid to say what I think in terms of sustainable living to kids, because they don't feel offended. With children, I look at their lunch boxes, and I probably shouldn't be doing this, but I just say, why do you have so much individually packed stuff, you know? Just get your mum to get a big bag and you can get it out of there and then use it that way. Maybe kids think about it. Maybe in the future they'll make different choices.
Did you have any experiences with people where they felt that you offended them?
People are quite keen to listen to me, and if they see me using my own bag, they just go, oh, where did you get that from? And I know some people purchased it. This could be the fact that I don't boldly maybe go to everybody, but sort of test the waters to see how they will take it. One of the things I do outside my home is that I also approach to cafes when I go, they're suggesting. So I think people can make a change that way if they want to go to the places that they often shop from and just suggest little things. Straws, or can you use reusable cups, can you use something that you can wash again, you know, stuff like that. One of my biggest goals in being a teacher is that I actually want to show them, lead them by example of how you can live sustainably, teach sustainably. You know, I'm a bit of a joke with my friends. They all know how passionate I am about it, and I'm never scared to tell them. And I don't think I'm brave enough to go out there and tell a total stranger on how they can improve in their sustainable living. I'm concentrating on the children in my care and my friends. Of course, I'm really concerned, and not just concerned about my kids, but, you know, and, you know, every child. But you've seen the uprising of, you know, young kids. I think they're taking it more seriously.
The striking thing about the climate strike is that the kids now are beginning to take this more seriously than the adults. Where are the adults? Why isn't it the adults that are striking? But secondly, how many adults are going out to support their kids, and how can we support our kids when they're going on strike on Friday? Well, there's a number of ways you could be supporting them by talking about it. As Jane Morton was telling us earlier, it's the conversation that's happening. That's really what's creating the change on the long term, isn't it? That this is not something where we're being told what to do, but it's because we are talking about how we feel and then we act.
And I think talking about it in a particular way, and that's where Greta is such a model. You know, she says adults say they want to give us hope, but we don't want hope. We want action. We want action out of the adults. And I think that doesn't just mean, you know, going along to the strike and the march in Melbourne on Friday. I think that's a really great thing to do. Obviously, do that. But what we need from the adults is actually some more courage than that. You know, we can support our kids by taking disruptive non-violent direct action. That's what they're doing in the United Kingdom. They went to the UK Parliament in October last year and said that if the UK Parliament didn't declare a climate emergency, they were going to rebel, and they did. Not that you would know from reading our newspapers, sadly, but they shut down 5 bridges in London during November. And
that was 6,000 people, wasn't it? It wasn't just a little group of 20 greenies.
No, no. It was 6,000 people, but hundreds of whom were willing to risk arrest. The police didn't have enough vans to take them away. And most recently they've done another one, very, very visual, with fake blood, non-toxic. But it was called Blood of Our Children, and they spilled just a vast amount of this red substance onto the streets. At the moment, the police are not arresting them because they know that they actually want to be arrested.
That's sort of interesting.
Yes. But
so is this coming to Australia, the Extinction Rebellion movement?
Mm. It's in Australia. It's in most of the large capitals, particularly Melbourne. And basically we're working up to the launch of the International Rebellion in Melbourne, and I think in other capitals. Declaration Day is the 22nd of March. That's when we go to various parliamentary offices and tell them that we want them to declare a climate emergency or we will rebel. And then the International Rebellion starts 15th of April. They're going to try and shut down London for much longer than a few hours. And in other countries, in 80 other countries, we're going to do whatever we can. It's probably not going to be one just in that month, but it's the start of waves of rebellion.
That's interesting because that is, in a way, the adults' response. So we have the kids' school strike happening on Fridays, Fridays for Future. But then this is like the next step up. That's the adult's way of doing it. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes people think, oh, we need 51% support. Well, we have already vast support. I think if you asked most people, would you risk your kids' future, you know, to keep the fossil fuel industry going, most people would say no. But what we need really is just 1 or 2% of brave people who are prepared to make some sacrifices. And the idea that the Extinction Rebellion is based on is that 500 people in jail will have more effect than 1 million people on the street. That's what we saw with, I don't know if you're old enough, to remember the Franklin blockade. You know, so when we were trying to save the Franklin River, people would go upstream in little inflatable canoes and boats, and that lot would be arrested, and the next lot would come to nonviolent training, and then they would go up the river and get arrested, and then the next lot would get trained, and then they go up the river until the Tasmanian jails were full. And it makes a lot of difference when people prepare to be brave.
So how many were arrested in those days?
Well, it was hundreds. I don't know how many.
I heard a figure like 1,600.
Did you? Yeah, look, it could easily be. I don't know. And it's similar to the Freedom Riders in America when they were taking the buses down south to challenge the segregation that was still happening down there. And 13 people started out. They were some of them from religion, some of them faith leaders. They were subjected to horrific violence. You know, the bus was burned and they were bashed up. And as they got further south, the buses wouldn't take them any longer because they didn't want to risk the violence. And they, at that point, stopped. But others came straight away into that terribly violent situation. And one of them, I can remember, gave up a university career, gave up university at the time of his final exams.
So, Jane, are you ready to be arrested?
I'm certainly ready to be arrested. I've risked arrest quite a number of times. It's quite hard in Victoria to get arrested. I've locked on inside the parliamentary offices twice and not actually been arrested.
Wow.
And I've also sat in Bill Shorten's office for many hours and in Downer's office.
But what makes you such a radical? I mean, you look like a normal person. You worked as a psychologist.
Yes, yes.
How does a psychologist become a radical out there on the front lines of fighting against fossil fuels?
Look, I still am a psychologist, and that is one of the risks that I run, because if I am arrested, it will be a challenge for my registration. I'll have to defend my registration. I do it because, well, actually, the brand of psychology I do is based on values and consulting your values. And to feel at rest within myself, I feel that if I know how serious it is, I have to do everything that I can. In some ways, it's a peaceful place, because if you do everything that you can, then I feel like whether it goes well or whether it goes badly, I won't die with regrets.
Do you feel like there's more people joining you, Jane? Like, you know, like at the Extinction Rebellion in London last year, you say about 6,000, like, if they're going to do this again, like, how many more people, like, you know, being right in there are joining, like, even for tomorrow Friday, when we have the student strike, I think last time in Melbourne there was, 1,000?
5,000
people. And like they're saying on Facebook, it's like saying 8,000 interested, like, you know, 15,000 interested, 8,000 going or something like that, you know, like just as an idea of like the growth.
Jackie, I have an interesting observation there because I think something is going on, and I base that on numbers because we have been posting for 6 years now. We've been posting videos and audio clips and everything, and usually if we got 3 likes and 5 shares, we'd be happy, you know. The latest video that I put up, 20,000 people have been seeing it. It's been shared thousands of times. It's been viewed. It's a video. Mm. It's been viewed 6,000 times. These are unprecedented numbers for the Sustainable Hour. And that's not because we're doing the job differently or better.
More people
are interested. Because now suddenly people are taking an interest.
Yes. Well, when we were at the Sustainable Living Festival, again, just signing people up for Extinction Rebellion, there were so many people just saying, we have been waiting for this. We've been sitting on the sidelines going, look, we know this is really serious, but we're not going to get involved in some piddly campaign that's not going to fix it. But now, this is it.
Hmm.
And particularly young people, it's quite tragic. You know, there's young people just saying, look, I have lived in fear my whole life, you know, because it's been known now for, you know, 10, 15 years that it's very serious. I've lived in fear my whole life with this. And now, finally, somebody is doing something.
Mm. And Greta is the one who stepped out of that fear, doesn't she? And she's now becoming such a global leader because she speaks with clarity. And we talked about the weapon of mass confusion just before.
Yes.
And here is Greta changing all that.
Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. But to do that, we have to speak clearly, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children.
We don't have to be confused. Mm. It's actually very simple and very clear what we need to do.
Mm. Yes, truth and courage. See, courage, I think, is much more important than hope. We don't know for sure now we can fix this. We've messed around, not us, we've been messed around.
A leader in that space, I think, is the New York, he's a co-editor of the New York magazine, I think it's called, David
Wallace-Wells. Yes, yes.
As somebody who's been reporting on climate change for 20 years, I am terrified by the prospect, similarly to you, yet I find myself at conflict with myself. I still take my family on foreign holidays on an aircraft.
Yeah.
I still drive a fossil fuel powered vehicle. We still consume in a way that I know is unsustainable for the planet. I don't have one child, I have three. How do we ensure those societal shifts? How do we get there? We're all in a state of, sometimes I worry, a sort of collective denial of our responsibilities.
I think
acting as individuals, I know if I stopped flying, it wouldn't make a tiny bit, it would make a minuscule, insignificant amount of difference on a planetary scale. How do we get over that fundamental societal problem?
I think the answer is politics. I mean, I think that's what politics is for, is to live up to aspirations collectively that we can't live up to individually. That's why when we talk about taxation, we don't ask people to make donations and, you know, hand over half their salaries to philanthropy. We collectively say this is the tax threshold that we want to impose on people because we collectively understand that this money should be redirected towards these goals. I think the same model holds true for climate. It's true that, you know, we could all lessen our carbon footprint. There's been a lot of talk recently about the impact of diet and travel, as you mentioned. I think people should take those steps if they feel compelled to. But as you say, I'm with you. these impacts at an individual level are trivial, the much more important impact is the impact you can have with your vote in electing people who really prioritize climate change, who are concerned about it as a sort of first-order political imperative, not as a fifth- or sixth-order political imperative, which is the way that most even liberal politicians in the UK and the US have treated it, and by mobilizing, organizing, and putting pressure on our existing policymakers to make sure that the environment in which we make those personal decisions about travel and diet and other things, the environment is governed by policy that makes each choice we make environmentally responsible. So that, you know, for instance, there's been a lot of talk about meat eating and the impact on the climate. There are studies, they're somewhat small scale, they haven't been shown at anything like a national level. But if you feed cows seaweed, you can cut their methane emissions by as much as 95 or 99%. Methane emissions are the only reason that beef is a climate problem. So we could theoretically legislate all cattle farmers had to feed their cattle seaweed, and then we wouldn't have to worry about how many hamburgers we were eating. And I just think the impact of that kind of policy change so towers over anything that you and I can do in our individual lives, that while it would be better if you and I behaved better, and I'm, as I say, in the same boat as you are, it's so much more important for us to be mobilizing and pushing for political change, because change of the scale that we need is only possible at the policy level. It just simply isn't possible for individuals to make that kind of difference.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
Jane, I want you to tell us about what's happening this evening, because you are in Geelong, not just as the guest of the Sustainable Hour, but actually because you're going to meet with people from Geelong later today.
Hopefully lots of you. I'm down at Beeves Bar from 6 till 8. I'll be talking a bit about the science, hopefully not for a really long time, too long to depress you, but talking about what we can do, because I think this is the moment. This is the moment to stand up. It's the moment to tell the truth. And it is the moment for peaceful but disruptive rebellion. And we'll be talking about the kids' strike, but we'll also be talking about what we as adults can do to step this up, to get action, to get an emergency declared, because we don't have time left to fight one thing at a time. We have to declare an emergency. We have to throw everything we've got at the problem. And that will be, I think, an enormous relief for us. It seemed at the start in 2016 a very hard task. I think now it's very doable. So come. I want to meet you all.
Excellent. That's definitely an invitation. I think you're right that by taking that extra step up and saying we need big solutions, it's not enough. As David Wallace Wells is saying, individual action is no longer sufficient. Individual action is good because it's a way for yourself to express how you feel. That's fine. So you should definitely do that. It'll make you feel better. But it's not going to solve what we're talking about here. We need much bigger action. And only governments really have that power because we need to change the laws.
Mm. But I think people know that in their hearts. And that's why, yes, sure, of course, change your light bulbs, you know. Have solar panels if you can afford it. But people know in their hearts that we need the government to do this. You can't do the scale and speed that's required.
And here's what people seem to forget, that governments don't just act, you know, out of their own ideas. Governments very much listen to what the people want. So the finger is constantly pointing back to, you know, the broader masses, the people, the population. What do they want? What do 80% of the population want? And if we're just quiet and not showing what we want, then politicians will just continue as they have been doing till now.
And look, the surprising thing is, especially at election time, like we are here now, how willing politicians are, perhaps, especially in a marginal electorate, say, let's say Kerangamite, to pledge to support the declaration of a climate emergency. We did this with our local member, Jed Carney, when she was facing a very close by-election. She pledged to support the declaration of a climate emergency, and she actually has, which is quite amazing.
Speaking of psychology, also the health workers, doctors, are stepping into this space. I just saw this morning on Twitter in Germany, there's some doctors standing there with hashtag climate emergency, a big sign in front of an ambulance.
Great.
Yeah. So they're calling for that the health sector begins to take this more seriously. And maybe one day, very soon, we will be seeing climate emergency rooms where hospitals create an extra room which is not for when you've broken an arm, but when you've broken something else up in your head, maybe, because you're worried about the future.
Well, I think hopefully in that emergency room they'll just be signing people up for Extinction Rebellion, because nothing makes you feel better quicker than taking strong action with some other good people. And as you were saying before, like I'm actually naturally a very timid person and very law-abiding. It's quite hard to go and risk arrest, but it's very uplifting. So
fantastic.
I do recommend it.
And what a great note to end this Sustainable Hour on. You did it, Jane. You got us through it. We went from death to solutions and everything in 1 hour. All from here, go out there, everyone who's listened, and
be the difference. Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh,
cinnamon, on that day. Okay, Mr. President, let's get into it. The fourth climate assessment is a definitive synthesis of the evidence. Have you read it yet? It's your report, straight from the executive. It says right here, produced by the White House. I've got summary notes for you to write down. You might want to lie down or raise an eyebrow. People are dying in America right now from high-powered supercharged hurricane torrents in the five category, or the four like Florence. 100-year storm every year is historic, but you just ignore it because your gut tells a different story. So you go to California like a tourist when the place is scorched and say they ought to rake the forest. You don't read climate change reports. Hot things burn more, Agent Orange. And if you're waiting for an economic incentive, the vulnerable sector losses are documented in the hundreds of billions. And you're on Twitter every time an immigrant gets a parking ticket. What's wrong, Mr. President? Did you confuse the climate with the weather? Weather is like your mood. Even you can have a minute of benevolent cool. Your temperament stays narcissistic and rude, and the climate stays getting hotter on a cold day. Okay, you're trying to hold your base, but there's snowflakes. Even they will go away when the special prosecutor shows his whole case. So brace yourself for the impact friction, trying to bring back Nixon, skinbag edition. You got elected as a big tactician, but cinnamon, you can't run from redemption.
Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, cinnamon, where you gonna run to on that day?
Only comes from confession and cooperation like the rest of your henchmen, so the rest can clean up the mess you left us. The extra decades of combustion engines sloshing around, extra cars on the ground, engineering solutions that are still not found. The high carbon count, we still gotta draw down. You're the toast of the fossil fuel market now, but the garbage found in a kid's lungs wheezing, that's what plagues the dreams of Ebenezer. Congratulations on a future without any meaning, either oblivion or haunted by many demons, or there's many paths to redemption. None of them involve apathy or inattention. None involve rejection of the scientific method. All of them involve coming straight to your senses. It means you heal. It's the next generation with extreme new zeal. It's the Green New Deal that we're keen to seal. The climate doesn't give a soybean how you feel. It cares about one thing, radiative forcing. You got in bed with Vladimir and Alexander Torshin, but that doesn't stop the sun scorching or the rotation of the Democratic door swing. Punishing Republicans, it's already started. Renounce Trump now or forever be tarnished. Join the bipartisan climate change caucus and back the carbon dividend act in Congress. It's gonna take a major mobilization to switch it up from Rosie the Riveter to Grandma's pension fund. And all the fossil fuel stock is divested from. Let the voices sing as one till redemption comes.
Temperatures rising, the woods are on fire. Oceans rising higher and higher. People rising, tides on the moon.
a man, where you gonna run to?